Well, good morning. That was a nice welcome. Everyone's had a good break over Christmas, haven't they? So as James said, I'm Matt, one of the church staff, and this morning, it's the last day of the year. It's January tomorrow. That means gym subscriptions are going through the roof, of course. All the dieting books are in the bestsellers. It is the month of self-improvement, is it not, January? New year, new you. We're in this culture where reinventing yourself, being the person you can be, is the order of the day. But of course, we all know, behind that, everybody is using outward means to get what they really want, which is internal acceptance. I don't think that's a controversial view. I think that's what's happening. I think we all know that. But with that in mind, we're going to look this morning at a text in the Bible called Psalm 139. Okay, there are loads of psalms, so we've got right up to Psalm 139. And this text speaks very intimately, if you're okay with that word, speaks very intimately of the connection between humanity and God. And it says something to that desire for approval and acceptance that everybody has. And somebody just yawned loud. Thanks, Anthony. Thank you. That was really encouraging. As we journey from one year to the next and some of us catch up on our sleep, it's a great time to step back and reflect on where we are. Where are we in the big picture of life? So these are some of the first verses in Psalm 139. And I'm just going to read each bit and we're going to go through. And it says, "You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down." Some of us need to do that. "You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely." And if you're not familiar with the Psalms, it's a part of the Bible that's basically a book of songs and prayers to God. Most of them written by a man called David, who was king of Israel, but he was also a fantastic singer-songwriter. And the thing was, at that time, you didn't get to know the king, like personally, like you knew who he was, but you didn't get to know him. He didn't have mates. He didn't have peers, people who were kind of on his level. He was too far up. He wouldn't be expected to share his innermost thoughts and feelings with anybody. He would be seen in kind of big regal occasions with all of his majesty, all of his robes and his crown and everything, but people wouldn't know him. But this king, David, describes a God who knows him very, very well, who even knows the mundane things about his life. This God knows his past, his present, and his future. He knows what he did last year. He knows what he'll do next year. He not only knows what David does, what he says, but what he thinks, what is going on in his soul. Now, I used to work with university students, and one of the things we did, we'd help people explore the Bible, and sometimes we would look at this exact passage and discuss it. And it was really interesting. If you showed this to the girls, the female students, they go, "Oh, isn't that lovely? You know, God knows all my thoughts and desires and my dreams, and oh, he just knows me so well, and you know, inside out, he just knows me, and isn't that wonderful? Isn't it incredible that God knows me so closely?" But if you showed this to the lads, they'd say, "What? God knows what I'm thinking. He knows what's going on. No one told me about this. This is terrible. What?" It was really interesting, the different approaches that people had to it. Men tend to be less comfortable with people knowing their thoughts, don't they? A little bit of a generalization, but broadly true. The thing is, David, this king, was not a good boy. If you read anything about his life, he got up to loads of bad stuff, really bad stuff, and he knew it. And he's very aware that God knows what he's like. And yet somehow, as we'll see, David has this supreme confidence about letting God be close to him. He knows that God knows what he's like, and yet he feels this complete freedom to just be himself. Complete freedom to be himself. So let's see how this unfolds in the rest of this psalm. He continues to write, "You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. I rise on the wings of the dawn. If I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, "Surely the darkness will hide me and the light will become night around me. Even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you." So here we see not just this idea of God being all-knowing, but he's all-present. He's all-present. He's everywhere. When David uses that phrase, wings of the dawn, it's kind of a way of saying the far east, and the far side of the sea is the far west. It's a poetic way of saying God is inescapable. And we might think, oh, this is the Bible. It's saying nice poetic things about God. It's saying positive things about God. But one of the features of the Psalms is it's not just nice theological words. It's people being real with God about what they really think and feel. And when David speaks of God's inescapability, I don't think he's just saying, isn't it wonderful that God's everywhere? I think he's also saying to God, I find it difficult that you're everywhere. I find it difficult. I struggle with the idea that I can't go off and do my own thing without you watching. I think he's saying he finds that difficult. And humanly, God's everywhereness is sometimes a joy and sometimes it's a frustration. It's annoying. And even the Bible acknowledges that that's just how we are. That's how we feel about it. Somebody once said that the greatest human desire is to be fully known, but the greatest human fear is to be fully known. I think there's a lot of truth to that. We want to be known because it's how we're made, it's in us, but we fear being known because we fear being rejected. To be fully known and be rejected would be awful. And because we know we're not perfect, we suspect that somebody that really knew us would reject us. And I think that's often our big fear with getting close to God. I mentioned before that I used to work with university students, and I've spoken to a lot of people about faith and the Bible, many of them extremely clever people, and there are all sorts of debates about these things around God and, you know, all the does God exist stuff. But I'm convinced the biggest struggle that people have, no matter how intelligent they are, and I have spoken to these people, is not that God is too distant, it's that he's too personal. That's the struggle with God. God is too personal. You can't go off and hide from him and do your own thing. And I think everybody intuitively knows that. And that's what bothers them. So while David articulates the struggle between great joy and great frustration about the inescapability of God, he doesn't leave it there. There is more to this. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body, and all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. These are some of the most poetically wonderful verses in the Bible. Some people believe that life is some sort of cosmic accident, in which case nothing is of any objective value whatsoever. But this psalm uses these words to describe God's intimate involvement in every single human life. Created, knit, made, woven. It's saying that your life is extremely deliberate. That bit at the end of it's verse 16, it says, "All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." It's saying it's not just about your birth, but that God ordained your whole days, your whole life. That means that David is saying something that's actually quite shocking. He's saying before the universe even came into existence, God knew everything about you. He knew everything. He knew what you would be doing on a wet Tuesday sometime in 2008. You don't even remember that. He knows. He knew what you'd have for breakfast every day. He knew when you'd get your first grey hair. For me, it's many years ahead, wonderfully. He knew what you'd call your children or will call them. He knows what day you will die. David then summarizes what he said so far. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I'm still with you. So he summarizes and reflects on what he's already said. And he just considers the breadth and complexity of God. The breadth and complexity of God. And it's overwhelming. It's too much. When he says God's thoughts are precious, he uses a Hebrew word. This was written in a language called Hebrew. That was usually used to describe diamonds. It's David's way of saying, I'm not ambivalent about this. What God thinks is genuinely valuable to me. But at the end of verse 18, he also says this phrase, when I awake, I am still with you. And he doesn't mean wake from sleep. The word used there means wake after death. Sleep and death were often associated in that culture. And David is saying he knows that God's presence stretches so far, it even goes beyond his own death, to awakening beyond the grave. And now he's delighted that God is so present, because even when he dies, God will still be with him. So even before the universe, right from right to after David's death, he knows God knows the whole thing, and he's there for the whole thing. Now that might seem like a good place for David to end his psalm. He surveyed life from birth to death and beyond, but he's got more to say, and this is quite interesting where David goes next. He says, "If only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." So at the end of the psalm, David does something very courageous. He talks about how much he hates his enemies, and then he invites God to search him, to kind of examine his heart. He's saying, "God, I hate this person, and especially this person, just so you know. And by the way, you're very welcome to examine meticulously all of my attitudes and how I approach things." This is bizarre. He knows God doesn't like it when he hates people, and he knows that God already knows him inside out. He's just said it. And here he is still inviting God into his inner life. And there's something about David's understanding of God that means he knows he can be fully himself with God and it's okay. He knows somehow that it's okay. He has this sense that God on the one hand knows all of his flaws and all of his darkness, and on the other hand, God is a safe place for him where he won't be rejected. And this stands out. You see, in the rest of the Old Testament, where this psalm is taken from, there's this strong idea that God does get angry when people do wrong. He doesn't like it. Nobody in the Old Testament seems to presume to be close to God because they know that they're down here and God's up there. But David has come to see something. And if you read the other things that David wrote, it becomes clear that he knows that somehow God has dealt with his shortcomings. David knows that God has dealt with David's wrongness. He somehow knows. The Bible calls it sin, but there's absolutely no need for fear of rejection in the way that David sees that he can approach God. 1,000 years after David lived, Jesus was the answer. He lived the life we should have. He took on the rejection we deserved. That's classic Christian theology. But why? Why does Jesus do those things? It's to enable what we see in this psalm. A meaningful, close relationship with God without any fear of rejection or shame or embarrassment. David intuitively knew somehow that God was going to deal with his sin. And Jesus is the key to it. You see, without Jesus, God's knowledge of everything we do is terrifying. His inescapability is frustrating, and his creation of each of us is ultimately fruitless. But with Jesus, God's knowledge of everything we do is reassuring. His inescapability is comforting, and his creation of each of us is joyous. So that's the psalm. I like it. I don't know about you. What does it have to do with us as we move from one year to the next? Well, what if we let that psalm change how we see the year that's just finished or finishing and the year that's about to start? What if you look back on 2017 and maybe things didn't go well? In fact, maybe things went quite badly. But what if they were the days that God ordained for you? How does that change how you see the year? What if you look back at the things that you did wrong last year, and you know that you did, and think, God knew that they were coming. He knew that they were going to happen. But with Jesus, there's complete forgiveness for all of those things available to me. How does that change how you see 2017? If you're here today and you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, maybe a friend brought you along, or maybe you enjoyed the carol service a couple of weeks ago and you're wondering why the production isn't so elaborate this morning, the bigger message is the same every week. Through Jesus, a relationship with your Creator is on offer this year and every year. And as a church, we've got stuff that's going to be going on through 2018 where we can all help each other with this. That's what we're about as a church. Similarly, if you look forward to 2018, and think, you know, this is might be a year where I can do some self-improvement. You know, I can get better at some things. That's fine. But what if you think this is a year when I can make it my mission to get really close to God? Whatever that means. Get really close to God. I know I can be real with him. I know because of what Jesus done, I can experience closeness to him. What would it be like if in a year's time you knew God better than you do now? How would that feel? How would you like that? There is absolutely no reason why that cannot happen whatsoever.